For those of you that are guests here this morning, we are in a series of conversations that I have entitled Happily Ever After. It's a conversation on the subject of marriage. And we've been talking together for the last several weeks about the subject of marriage and looking at some different principles about how best to think about marriage and things that we can do, ways in which we can live out our marriage relationship that enhance the probability that we can, in fact, live happily ever after. The truth is, virtually all of the things that we've talked about have been leading up to this morning. And I say that for one very simple reason. Despite all of the principles that we learn, despite all of the efforts that we make, the simple truth is, none of us do this perfectly. Every one of us, from time to time, and sometimes more often than not, end up finding ourselves in situations where there's conflict, there's disagreement, there's disharmony, and we need to understand how to go about living out our married life in those moments in a way that actually promotes the unity of the relationship. I've noticed something. I do a lot of marriage counseling, and I do a lot of pre-marriage counseling. And notice that there is one skill that is missing from most couples more than any other. Any idea what that might be? I would say that the number one skill that is missing in most couples is the ability to resolve conflict. Conflict resolution skills are probably the last thing. And the truth is, they don't come naturally to any of us, do they? You want to answer yes to this? Don't. Because then we'll have to send you to liar school. Does resolving conflict come easily for anybody? To develop the skills, we have to learn the attitudes because they just simply do not come easily to us. Now, every week we talk about this. Anytime you do an extended series on marriage, you run a bit of a risk. And the risk is that there are always people in the room that aren't married. And you don't want to do an elongated series that leaves a segment of the audience out. And so we've worked very hard at teaching principles that are applicable to a broad range of relationships. Listen, if you are here today, and you are, just wanted to state the obvious, if you're here today, you have to deal with conflict. I mean, there is not a person alive that doesn't have a relationship that has some degree of conflict in us. None of us live this out so perfectly with other people who live it out so perfectly that we're all devoid of conflict. If you imagine you're devoid of conflict, you've probably been emotionally anesthetized and you just don't know what's going on. And so this subject, probably more than any other we've talked about, is applicable to every person who's in this room today. Now, every week I've been telling you we're going to itemize one major simple concept. I repeat this every week. I didn't say it was easy. I just said it's simple to understand. And this week, the concept is equally simple. I would summarize it this way. Don't get into a bad fight and don't waste a good one. Now, I want you to think through that a little bit. Don't get into a bad fight and don't waste a good one. Now, that states pretty directly that there are good fights and there are bad fights. And you need to stay away from the bad ones and you need to take full advantage of the good ones. Now, by fights, I don't mean the knockdown, drag-out fights that might occur in some of your homes. Don't know. Those are all bad. Stay away from those. But by fights, what I'm referring to are the conflicts that come up in your life. The places where there's tension and you bang heads and you bang emotions and you have to find resolution to those things to keep the marital relationship moving forward in harmony. Now, let's make sure that we understand what we're talking about before we unpack it to any great extent. The first hurdle that most of us have to get over is the idea that there can be a good fight. Now, I think the vast majority of us probably sit back and say, listen, all conflict is bad. I mean, if there's conflict, somebody had to sin, right? And normally it's the other guy. But somebody had to sin. You know, I'm just not convinced that's true. Is it really sinful to misunderstand someone? Really sinful to think differently than somebody else? To perceive things differently than someone else might perceive it? I don't think so. No, it's not. You know, hear me well on this. It's easy to turn any conflict into a bad fight. That's easy to do. All you got to do is be selfish. You can turn any conflict into a bad fight by being proud and arrogant and selfish and doing dumb things. That's easy to do. But some of the greatest people in the Bible were engaged in conflict with some of the other greatest people in the Bible. Are you sure that all conflict is bad? I mean, Jesus even instigated conflict from time to time, didn't he? In fact, if you want to know the whole truth about it, is I think Jesus was a bit of a troublemaker from time to time. He kind of liked going around and asking the hard questions and stirring people up and getting them all riled up because he knew something. They were going to have to think deeply and think differently when he left, and they might grow as a result of it. Conflict is inevitable. Conflict is even inevitable among Christian people. Listen to me. Two entirely spiritual people with right motives can find themselves in conflict. It's possible. It happens in our marriages, doesn't it? I mean, it's just the way it is. You say, Don, how can conflict ever be a good thing? It can be a good thing when it leads to greater understanding and greater closeness between the two of you. I mean, think about this for a moment. You and your spouse are on divergent paths. No great moral issue involved. This isn't an issue of biblical truth. It's a matter that the two of you see something differently, and as a result of that, you're naturally moving in different directions. No one's being intentionally selfish. No one's being overly aggressive about it. You just see things differently, and as a result of that, you're headed on different directions on a particular issue. Now, which is better? To ignore the fact that you're headed in different directions and hope that somehow out there it's going to get magically resolved, or to sit down together, have a conversation, treat each other like you love each other, act like Christian people are supposed to act and talk like Christian people are supposed to talk, and come up with a solution and proceed in harmony? Which is better, to ignore it or to work through it? I maintain that it's far better to work through it and to bring resolution to it. If you ignore the conflict and do nothing, then what's going to happen? You're both going to continue on divergent paths for quite a while. And the longer you stay on those divergent paths, the more difficult it's going to be to bring that relationship back together again. Because they're continuing to move away from each other, not closer to each other. And consequently, things move apart. But if you'll sit down and talk about it and come up with a solution that you can both live with and thrive in, then, first of all, the relationship gets stronger, the relationship gets closer, and isn't that a good thing? I mean, isn't that better than the alternative here? You say, well, the best solution is that we don't have conflict. That's a fairy tale. I mean, I'm just being honest with you. That is not the way it works all the time. The fact is, we're all going to have conflicts. You say, well, all right, so then what makes a bad fight? I mean, if good can come out of this, if there can be such a thing as a good fight, what makes a bad fight? Well, a fight can be bad because, first of all, it's all about the wrong things when we're selfish about it. We've talked about this. Remember a few weeks ago, we talked about the two greatest problems in marriage are what? Pride and selfishness. And when pride and selfishness come into it, and they're driving what we're fighting about, then you can pretty much count on the fact that's going to be a bad fight. Because it's going to call on all kinds of emotions that are negative. It's going to produce all kinds of contention that's going to be very difficult to resolve except in one person's favor when they sit there and say, it's got to be this way or else. Now, fight can also be bad because of the way we approach it. I mean, when the only possible answer to a problem is to do it my way or else, that's a bad approach. That's a flawed approach, and you're not going to end up with a good solution coming out of that. So one of the keys to living happily ever after is don't get into a bad fight. Stay away from those fights that are driven by your selfishness, that are driven by your pride. Stay away from those conflicts where the only solution is to do it my way or else. But above all, don't waste a good one. Don't waste a good one. You say, well, Donna, how do you waste a good fight? Well, I think there are two ways that you can waste a good fight. Number one is by not resolving it. If you don't resolve it, then you don't get the benefit of finding a solution and bringing the relationship together in a way that is closer. Now, I'm going to show you in a few minutes why I think this is so critical. But I'll just tell you up front, one of the things that brings deep-seated, long-term marital disharmony is the fact that in many, many relationships, the conflicts never get resolved. They get talked about a lot. They get argued about a lot. They may even get yelled about a lot. But they don't get resolved. There's not a a course of action that is agreed upon. There's not an approach from that moment on of how we're going to live together in a way that is mutually beneficial to us. And so what's the result of it? The result is that we live with these things and the tension continues to mount, and it takes less and less to set off one of those conflicts every time because there's been no resolution to it. If a conflict is going to have the benefit that it's designed to have, then it has to get resolved. But you can also waste a good fight by resolving it in a way that just doesn't promote closeness and understanding. You know, sometimes couples get into a conflict and one becomes aggressive and the other just gives in. And they go on believing, well, we resolved that one, except there is no greater understanding and there is no more closeness as a result of it. And if a conflict doesn't produce closeness and understanding, you wasted it. I mean, that's the opportunity in the conflict. When that happens, one is simply appeased and the other one is just sitting around waiting for the next shoe to drop because they know it's going to drop. I mean, it's just a matter of time before the issue comes up again and the conflict recycles again. Folks, you have a choice. You can either resolve the conflict or you can recycle it. I mean, those are the choices. And if you recycle it, every time you recycle it, emotionally we get a little bit more sensitive, don't we? And as time goes on, you get a lot of static in your relationship. Before we try to understand, way to go, that was quick. Now, before we try to understand how conflict actually develops, let me make another observation to you. There are some disagreements in marriage. There's some issues in marriage that occur simply because we are different people. You ever notice that? Is anybody other than, this is going to be hard. It was easy in the first service. My wife wasn't sitting right there. Is there anybody else in the room who married their polar opposite besides she and I? I'm not sure it would be possible to have picked someone and chosen to spend my life with someone and to love someone who's much more different than I am, than her. The truth of the matter is, it is the fact that she is so different, I think, that was one of the reasons why I initially loved her. And it never ceases to amaze me how our kind of natural reaction is, we love the other person because they're so different and they bring something to the relationship that we don't have until we get married, and then we want to change them to look like us. I mean, think about it. Does that make any sense to anybody here? And yet that's exactly what we tend to do. Now, let me use just a frivolous example. It's much easier to use frivolous examples than it is to use real ones because they don't hurt as much. So let me use a frivolous example or two here for a minute to illustrate my point. How many of you in this room are neatniks? I mean, everything has to be in its place. Everything has a place. And if it's not in the place, then you kind of, you know, you're uncomfortable and maybe to the point where you start twitching a little. Come on, how many of you fit that category? How many of you, some of you are lying right now and I know you. Yeah. But now, how many of you that are neatniks are married to a messy? In their life, everything is in its place because wherever it is its place. You know, and they're perfectly comfortable with that. How many of you think that's going to change? Now, I mean, you may mitigate it some. You may modify it a little bit. But I'll guarantee you, under the right provocation, all those things that are naturally part of us are going to show up again. How many of you are morning people? Come on, don't you lie. And how many of you morning people are married to night people? You know, telling you the truth, I love this woman dearly. She wakes up every morning at 5 o'clock with a smile on her face, wanting to talk. No, that just shouldn't be. You know, if I haven't had a shower and at least 2 cups of coffee, I'm not interested in hearing a sound. Again, you know, we can laugh about the frivolous ones. But the truth of the matter is, there are parts of our personalities that are just dramatically different from each other. How we think, how we go about doing things. And those things sometimes become a source of conflict. And the question I want to pose is should they? I mean, after all, we knew that person. We chose that person. We loved that person. We married that person. Do you realize that the experts tell us that 69% of the conflicts that we have in marriage are related to those kinds of differences? 69% of them. I know people who have ended up divorcing because they wouldn't make adjustments to a personality that they knew was present before they ever got married. And then I think about what the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Ephesus in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 2 when he says, "Always be humble and gentle." Well, we could stop there and spend a lifetime, couldn't we? Do you know how many marriages could be enhanced? How many conflicts could be reduced and eliminated if we just came at them from a perspective of humility and gentleness? How much easier it would be to resolve conflict if we didn't act like we had the only right answer and that we were genuinely concerned about what happened to the other person? Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love. Don't raise your hand. But I'm just curious how many of you, some of those differences that you giggled about and thought was so cute before you got married, fall into that category of faults after you got married. And the Bible's pretty clear about this. You make allowances for them. You accept them. Why? Because of your love. Your love's bigger than that. You're bigger than that. And if we don't learn to accept some things and understand that every difference doesn't have to be reconciled, but that we can accept some differences in each other and not just accept them, but revel in them and enjoy and take advantage of the fact that we are very different people brought together and bound together by the Spirit of God in a way that allows us to function and to resolve conflict. Now, 31% of the conflicts in marriage aren't those kind. 31% of the conflicts in marriage can be resolved. They're not just things we accept in each other. They're issues that need to be resolved. They can be resolved if we're willing to change. Now, I mean, think through that for a moment. If you're here and your spouse is here and you're going in divergent directions, it's going to take more than just saying, I'm going to turn around and move toward you. You're going to have to change to make that happen. And most likely, both of you are going to have to make some changes to make that happen. But it's possible to resolve those conflicts if you are willing to change. And so I want to spend the next several minutes talking to you about those conflicts that can be resolved, should be resolved, and understanding how the conflict develops and how we respond to conflict, and then to answer the question, how should we respond to conflict? All conflict develops in a fairly predictable pattern. All you got to do is kind of watch it happen. There's one of the things about learning about this kind of stuff. That is, you go home and you say, I know what stage we're in. Kind of disconcerting. But it kind of happens in those kind of stages. And all conflict begins with tension. Sometimes the tension is understood. Sometimes it's not very well defined. Tension occurs when there is a perceived incompatibility of ideas or actions, beliefs, values, goals, desires. In other words, you disagree about something that you perceive to be important. You know, differences and disagreements turn into conflict when tension develops over something that's important to us. And then you interject into that selfishness that we've talked about. And all of a sudden, it's real easy to see conflict develop. It can become enormously volatile in those moments. In reality, this tension stage, when that first tension starts to show its head, that's the best time to resolve the conflict. That's the best, the easiest time to sit down and talk about it and say, you know, listen, I'm uncomfortable with something. Can we talk about it? Now, that's not so difficult to say, is it? And yet most of us don't do that, and I'll tell you why. Because when we can't specify exactly what it is, it feels petty to go to someone and say, you know, there's something wrong here. Well, I mean, maybe find a different way of saying it, but if you're uncomfortable and there's tension developing, understand what comes next if you don't do this. Because what happens next if you don't resolve it at this point is it goes to what is called confusion. Now, what is confusion? Confusion is nothing more nor less than the fact that somebody's not acting like they're supposed to act. You know, in marriage, we get so used to, I mean, things are so stable after years, right? I mean, this person is, they always do this, and they're supposed to do that. I mean, our life's built on people acting the way they're supposed to act, right? But when tension develops and somebody starts acting a little differently, we get confused and we say, all right, what's going on? Now, again, that's the perfect time to sit down. I mean, if ever there's a time to talk about it, that's the time to talk about it. Why? Because it's the next best time to the first stage, and it's way better than waiting until the next stage. And so ideally, you sit down and you talk about it at this point. And you try to sort out what's causing that confusion. But if it isn't resolved at this stage, and you know why it isn't, don't you? It's because we're scared. None of us like to engage in conflict. And we're afraid if we ask the question, what are they really going to tell us? I mean, isn't it crazy after you can be married to somebody for not years, but decades, and you're still sometimes apprehensive of what they're going to really tell you if they tell you the truth? And so we get terribly frightened, and we don't say anything. And we have no idea what we're setting ourselves up for. Because if you don't resolve it at this point, the next stage is we go to what is called the arming stage. What do I mean by that? I mean, we prepare for the battle. We're fairly convinced at this point that things can only get worse from here. They're not automatically going to get better. Something inside of us is afraid to find out what the issue really is. And so instead, we start arming ourselves for what we believe is the inevitable fight. And we build all of our emotional defenses. And we start collecting all of our emotional ammunition because we're fairly convinced that things are going to get worse. I'll even tell you what this looks like. When things get into the more emotional, difficult areas, what do? We sit back and we start looking back over the past history of our relationship, and we pull this instance out here and we pull this one out here, and you know, not a single one of us ever pulls out the good times, do we? We sit and we look at all those times in which that person did this to me, and over here they did this to me. And that's kind of the spin we put on it. And then there's this incident, and we take them and we start building this fortress that validates the fight that we think is coming. I told the first service a story. I told them I wasn't going to tell it in this one, but I'm going to. I remember an incident. It's way easier to tell when the one you love isn't sitting there. But I remember the incident in which... I don't remember the cause, but Ann and I were struggling with something and had been for a little while. I went to bed bothered. There's a reason why Paul tells us in Ephesians 4:26, don't let the sun go down on your anger. There's a reason why you shouldn't go to bed angry, because if you do, there's a high probability you're going to wake up a couple hours later. And I did. I woke up a couple hours later and I was upset, and I sat there and I did exactly what I just described. I went back over and I pulled out that instance in which she did that. And I picked this one up and put that into my kind of mental construct of what was going on in this fight. And it wasn't too long before I was absolutely convinced that I was sleeping beside Attila the Hun. And I laid there for several hours, quite honestly. And shortly before 5 o'clock, that was the drop dead hour, shortly before that, God started to do something in my heart. I just started to remember all the good stuff. And when 5 o'clock rolled around and the alarm clock went off, and both of us probably woke up a little bit apprehensive about what was going to happen, not trying to resolve anything, I just said, babe, can we spend some time tonight and talk? And we spent, I don't even remember how long. And we sat down and we found a solution and we talked our way through whatever it is. I'm just telling you, that doesn't happen very often at this stage. When it gets to the arming stage, and you start collecting all of that emotional ammunition, you know why you're collecting it? Because you plan on using it. And what comes next, the next stage of this thing is the fight. Can I just say one thing about the fight? It never ceases to amaze me that the only two places that I can think of where there are no rules of engagement is in a street fight and marriage. Entire nations can go to war with each other, and they're governed by the Geneva Convention. There are some things they just can't do. They're so heinous that they're outlawed by international law. And yet in marriage, it never ceases to amaze me that unless you take the Bible seriously, there are no rules of engagement. And people say and do the most horrible things to each other. People that they have chosen, people that they have loved. And yet for some reason, some issue is so much more important than the person that we end up saying despicable things to each other. Can I just tell you, there ought to be some things you'll never do. There ought to be some things that you will never say to each other. There ought to be some rules of engagement. We really ought to take the Scripture seriously about how we talk to each other. That's why we spend time talking about that. Because if there's ever a time in which the biblical principles of communication are going to get tested, it's when they're in the middle of conflict. Well, there's one more stage after the fight. Then there comes a stage that's called adjustment. I hate the term. Because it sounds like once we're done, we're just going to tweak things a little. And the fact is, that could be it, or it could be much bigger than that. What we're really saying here is this. There was a time in which the relationship was working in one way, and tension came into it. There was a difference. There was a disagreement. And we did something to cause it, and all of a sudden, we didn't know what to expect from each other. And so we overreacted, and we prepared ourselves for battle, and we just went through this big fight. And now there's this sense of emotional relief that comes from it. But now we have to redefine that part of the relationship. We have to answer the question, if this caused confusion over here, how are we going to resolve this in a way that allows us to move forward in harmony together? Now, the truth of the matter is, adjustments take many forms, don't they? I mean, they can be as simple as, yes, honey, I will get up every morning and I will take the garbage out. That's a pretty simple adjustment, isn't it? Or it can be as difficult and as complex and as wide sweeping as, if I'm done and I'm out of here, my lawyer will call your lawyer. You know what my concern is here? Even for good Christian people, is I can't tell you how many couples go through that cycle, go through the fight, get an emotional release, and never figure out what the adjustment's going to be. And we're not talking about those things that are kind of the personal things that we just need to accept about each other. We're talking about issues that are critical to their ability to move forward together. And they don't resolve those. And so if you don't resolve them, what happens? Well, you get through that emotional release. You don't solve the problem. You go on acting like you've solved it until it comes up again. And then you go through that entire cycle again, and you come around and you have the big fight and you have the blow up and you say all the same things all over again. And if you don't resolve it then, you go through it again. Only before long, somebody emotionally turns off and they say, I'm done. I'm just not going to keep going through this. Folks, that's exactly why it's so critical that you actually figure out how to resolve the conflict. Because what's at stake here is your marriage, it's your future. You say, well, how do we do that? We need to understand how we tend to respond to conflict. All conflict resolution is the balancing of two values, two things that are really important to us. The first of those, I put it in these terms, how much do you care about the other person? How much do you love them? How much do you really care? You know, we may try hard to stay out of conflict, but if we're unable, at some point we're going to have to say, I'm in conflict with a person, and how much do I care about that person? The second issue is, how much do I want what I want? How important are my goals, my dreams? What's my self-interest in this? And if you think about it, all conflict resolution is a balancing of those two issues. How much do I care about the other person, and how much do I want what I want? And you say, well, what if I love the person dearly, but I care deeply about the issue? You're married. I mean, that's where we find ourselves most of the time, isn't it? Now, ask yourself the question. Let's kind of map this out a little bit so you can see it. What happens if you don't care all that much about the issue and you don't care all that much about the person? Well, we just kind of say, I'm not going to engage it. Now, if you don't engage the conflict, there's no way to ever resolve it, is there? And sometimes that's entirely appropriate. Sometimes you don't care all that much about the issue, and sometimes you don't care all that much about the person. I mean, they're just not a big person in your life. And it's all right to say, I'm just not going to engage the conflict. I have opinions about a lot of things that I never tell you guys about. Some of you would be well served to do the same thing. You know, now here's the deal. If you say, I won't engage the conflict, there's no way it's ever going to get resolved. And my concern is this, that in some cases, people say they don't care, but they do. They're deceiving themselves. And what happens? It's what I call the tea kettle effect. It's like taking a bunch of stuff and putting it in a tea kettle with a little water and sitting it on the back burner and turning the heat on simmer and just let it sit there. Sooner or later, it's going to get hot enough and the lid's going to come off, and all that sludge is going to come out. And that happens when you're dishonest about this stage. So if you say no way, you better mean no way. The second question would be, what happens if I care greatly about the person, and I don't care all that much about the issue? What do you say? I'm going to give in. Seems appropriate and seems reasonable, doesn't it? I mean, it's okay to say, it can be your way. I mean, I understand we have a difference of opinion, but in this case, I don't care all that much about my opinion. I am more than happy for you to have your way, and you can have it. But again, you better mean it. Because if you don't, then there's going to be latent resentment that builds up when that other person actually gets their way, and you're sitting over here mumbling under your breath because, well, I really wanted this. Well, if you really wanted that, why didn't you stay with it and resolve the conflict instead of saying you can have it your way? Now, again, there are lots of times in marriage where it's entirely appropriate to say, hey, have your way. It's fine. There's a third possibility, and that is, what if you care a great deal about the issue, but you don't care all that much about the person? You say, well, I'm going to get my way. You know, and I'll do whatever it takes to get my way. And sometimes that means we literally attack each other, verbally, physically. But we strongly go after what we want because we want what we want, right? Can I tell you, if this is a natural response for you, this is the most selfish approach to resolving conflict I can imagine, other than possibly being dishonest about no way. But to just demand your way, I mean, what that essentially says is, I know right in this circumstance, and there is no other possible answer to this other than my way. And my desires, my wishes, my goals, my dreams are more important than yours are. And so it's okay for me, by whatever means, to get my way. Now, there's a fourth way in which conflict gets resolved. I call it halfway. The experts call it compromise. No offense intended. This is how Congress works. They work by compromise. You know, imagine for a moment I write a bill, And I want to enact it into law, and so I write my bill, and I go to you, and I say, I want you to support my bill. And you look at me and say, I don't like your bill. And I say, well, how can you not like my bill? I wrote it. You know, I mean, it's a great bill. He says, I don't like your bill. I'm not going to support it. And I said, well, all right, I'll tell you what. You have a bill that's coming up before long, and right now I haven't supported it. But I could, if you'll support my bill. So he says, well, okay, that's a fair trade-off. And what in essence happens is I give up something to get something. That's how compromise works. Now, on the surface, that's not such a terrible thing, except compromise tends to be driven toward those things that we give up or we get. And I don't think that's the best way to think about it. There's a fifth alternative in here. And that fifth alternative simply says, what if I care deeply about the person and I care deeply about the issue? And we're right back to marriage again, aren't we? Because that's where we live a lot of our lives. We live a lot of our lives trying hard to find ways to resolve differences, different directions, different opinions with someone that we love dearly. And the question is, how do you do that? I mean, I'll tell you exactly what it takes. It takes bringing two people together. The technical term is collaboration. It's taking all of the participants in the conflict, putting all of their needs, all of their interests, all of their expectations, all of their dreams on the table and saying, now, listen, let's figure out how to get the most we can possibly get for everybody. And both sides have to work to bring about that solution. You say, well, Don, that sounds so easy. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But it's not. It's not that easy. And you say, well, how do I do that? Well, don't look at the clock, first of all. Because I'm going to answer two questions in 10 minutes. And at 10 minutes, I'm going to just dissipate from the stage. But I'm going to give you 5 spiritual principles and 7 steps in 10 minutes. Are you ready? You need to write. Okay? 5 spiritual principles that are necessary for you to be able to genuinely resolve conflict in a collaborative fashion. Number 1, decide if the problem warrants confrontation. Not every fight has to be fought. Not every offense has to be confronted. Not every problem has to be solved. Proverbs 19:11 says, sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by what? Overlooking wrongs. When was the last time you overlooked a wrong? Just said, I'm going to extend grace. I don't need to deal with this. This is out of character with the person. It'll get resolved. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 8, most important of all, continue to show what? Deep love for each other. Why? Because love covers a multitude of sins. Wise is the person that figures out what things you must confront and what things you should leave alone. If it's a pattern of life, you probably got to confront it. If it's not, you might want to think about just extending some grace. Number 2, if you know there's a problem that threatens the relationship, initiate resolution. I would say that to both of you. If you know there's a problem that threatens the relationship, love the other person enough that you're willing to initiate resolution. Go to them in humility. Go to them in gentleness and say, listen, there's a problem. It may be me. I'm willing to accept that possibility, but there's a problem and we need to talk about it. Keep your anger under control, but above all, initiate it. You know, we talked about this last week, Matthew chapter 5. It says, so if you're presenting a sacrifice at the altar in the temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, I find that language really fascinating. I would expect him to say, if you remember that you have something against someone. No, he says that somewhere else. Here he says, listen, if you even know that another person, if you know your spouse has something against you, you need to get up, take them by the hand, go out in the lobby, have a conversation, and when you're done, come back in and worship. Now, don't all do it at once. But read on. It says, go and be reconciled to that person. Leave your sacrifice there. Go and be reconciled to that person. And then come after your sacrifice to God. You know what he's saying? He's saying the value of loving each other is so intrinsically tied to your love of God that your worship is a problem if you're not reconciled to other people. Number three, approach your spouse and the problem with humility. Approach it from a position of humility. He says in a verse that we've already read in Ephesians 4:2, always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love. He says, make allowance for your faults. Now, make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit, binding yourselves together with peace. But you got to be humble and gentle. Why is it? Because humility is the fertile soil in which almost every other virtue grows. I'm just telling you, you can try to develop a whole bunch of Christian virtues, and if they're not planted deeply and rooted deeply in humility, you're going to have a tough time growing them and making them work. Humility, being willing to come in and say, listen, this may be my problem. And if it's my problem, would you help me? Instead of coming at it from, this is your problem and you need to fix it. Makes all the difference in the world. It says in Proverbs 13, verse 10, pride leads to conflict. Those who take advice are wise. Those who will humble themselves enough to listen to somebody else and seek advice, they're wise people. You come at this from the perspective of pride, I guarantee you it's not going to go well. Next principle, take care of your own faults first. Now please don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you you got to be perfect before you can confront something. I'm not telling you that. I admit that would probably cut down on a lot of conflict resolution, wouldn't it? None of us would ever get to go to anybody because none of us are perfect. But what's the point here? The point is that if you have issues in your own life, there's at least a possibility that those are obscuring your vision and your ability to see the issues in the other person. Jesus said that. Remember Matthew 7? In Matthew 7, beginning in verse 2, he says, for you will be treated as you treat others. Now, we all know that's true, right? I mean, that just tends to be how it works. The standard you use in judging is the standard by which you will be judged. How you treat others, how you judge others, what goes around comes around, right? I mean, that's kind of a basic rule. And why worry, he says, about a speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own? He says, what's the deal here? You're worrying about something of minuscule importance while all of a sudden you have this great issue. Now, I know something. And that is, it doesn't take a very big speck in your own eye to look and feel like a big log. You know, I mean, you get something stuck in your eye and it hurts. And it's constantly irritating, and it's constantly bothering you, and it obscures your vision and your ability to see. And so what happens? This little thing all of a sudden becomes huge, and all the while you're trying to picture what's going on in your friend or your spouse's mind and their eye, and he says, listen, you can't do that. How can you think of saying to your friend, let me help you get rid of that speck in your eye, when you can't see past the log in your own eye? Hypocrite, first deal with the log in your own eye and you will see well enough to be able to deal with the speck in your friend's eye. So if it's dealing with this issue, you may need to fix some things in your own life, then you have the capability of helping your friend address it or your spouse. Deal with your own issues first. Number five, if you're wrong, seek forgiveness. If you've been wronged, grant forgiveness. We're going to talk next week about forgiveness. This is huge. You really have to understand what forgiveness is and how it plays out in your life. Because I'm telling you, the vast majority of marriages that explode and fall apart, it's because somebody or both have never forgiven for something that's happened in the past. And it's just added to, and it's gotten bigger and bigger, and it never gets fixed. Now, what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is not a feeling. I'm giving you a 30-second preview. It's not a feeling, it's a promise. Forgiveness is a promise that you make to somebody else that you will not allow that issue to destroy your relationship. You will not dwell on it. You will not bring it up and use it against them. You'll not talk about it to somebody else. It is a promise that you make to another person. That's exactly what God did to you. We'll talk about it next week. Now, why do I talk about those five spiritual principles? Because if you don't get those right, the next seven steps are meaningless. The seven steps just aren't going to help you if you don't get the attitudes right behind it. But here they are. Seven practical steps. Number one, clearly define the problem. Know what you're fighting about. I can't tell you how many people I know who are in conflict, and they're in conflict over different things. One person's solving this problem, and the other person is solving this problem. Sit down together, define the problem, write it down. Number two, direct your energy at the problem, not at the person. You say, well, the person is the problem. No, it's not. Keep in mind, this is the person you married. This is the person you chose. This is the person you love. There may be behaviors that are problematic. They may be causing issues that are problematic. But you can't solve the person. That's God's job. He'll deal with that one. You need to deal with the problem. Direct your energy at the problem, not at the person. Number three, list the ways you both contribute to the problem. Hear me. Each of you list the ways you contribute to the problem. Don't start writing down stuff that the other person does that contributes to the problem. That's their job. You worry about you. This is the process of owning your part of this thing. And when you own your part, then there's a possibility of resolving it. Number four, then sit down together and brainstorm solutions. This is a problem, remember? There's normally more than one solution. If there's only one solution, this is easy. Gut it up and do it. It's your only choice. But normally there are multiple possible solutions. Come up with a list of them. And then number five, agree on one that you'll try. Pick the one that makes the most sense. Pick one. Try it. You know, a lot of couples have come to this point and then come back later and say, well, I tried it and it didn't work. And you say, well, what did you do? Well, and when you get the truth out, they never did anything. They talked about it, but they never did anything. You have to agree on one you'll try, and then number six, agree on what you'll both do to implement that solution. Both of you contributed to it. Both of you have to work at fixing it. After all, this is a marriage. You're in this mess together, right? You're in this mess together until death do you part. So you better figure out how you can both implement the solution. Then number seven, follow up and adjust as necessary. Come back and ask yourself, did it work? If it didn't work, what do we have to do to fix it? What do we have to do differently? How can we proceed? How can we actually make something happen? Listen to me carefully. Your marriage is worth it. Because your marriage is a living illustration of the love that Christ has for the church. Don't mess it up. Father, thank you. Thank you this morning for your word. It speaks clearly to us, sometimes in very difficult ways. But I pray for couples in this room today who today are in conflict, who, quite frankly, it's a minor miracle that they sit in the same room side by side. And I pray that today would be a day of new beginnings. A day in which that couple might go home and say, you know, we can do this. And if we need some help, let's get some help. Who can help us do this? But we can solve this problem together. And the result of that is that we'll find out all over again how much we genuinely love each other. And the relationship grows stronger. And the agreement grows greater. And your understanding of each other is enhanced. We ask for that result. Through Jesus Christ. Amen.